You're listening to The After Show, the bonus episode series for On Tour with Brian Ray. This is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, and I'm your host, Mandy Wimmer. In The After Show, we dive a little deeper into Brian's thoughts about certain parts of the interviews, as well as expound a bit more on his own experiences on tour. In this episode, we covered a little bit of everything. Why Eva's famous father, Kim Gardner, may not have wanted her to follow in his footsteps, and Brian's advice for kids passionate about the music industry on taking the opportunity or finishing school, as well as how important it is to read music. We get into how musicians have the uncanny ability to compartmentalize on stage when dealing with something traumatic off stage, the importance of bonding with your band off stage, and dive a little deeper into just how it was possible for Eva to get her head stuck in the bass drum. Here's my conversation with Brian Ray. Good afternoon, Brian. Here we are, episode 5, which I actually think I said episode 5 last time, but today is the real episode 5 after show.
The real episode 5.
We talked to Eva Gardner this week, the bassist for Pink. And I got to say, I mean, Eva, super, super talented, very grounded, very impressive person. I really enjoyed her.
I agree. Yeah, she's rare and wonderful, and what a story, and what a great record of success.
Yeah, and you've known Eva, I mean, you've known her family forever, which I thought was really cool. So yeah. Kim Gardner, her dad, who was a big part of the British invasion, yeah. How did you know him?
Well, I think we first met at his pub called the Cat and Fiddle Pub, which was initially stationed up in Laurel Canyon at where Pache, that restaurant, is, where we've been together.
Yes, I love that restaurant.
That's where the Cat and Fiddle originally was, under the Laurel Canyon Market, the famous only market in Laurel Canyon. Wow. It's under there, and that's a very old building from the turn of the last century.
And that's not where it is now, then?
No, it is not. It has moved a few times since then. But anyway, I used to go to that pub because I used to like pubs.
And we know.
Yes. I drank them dry. No. And now I don't do the pubs very often, except to visit Eva and her mom. But that's where I met Kim Gardner. And he couldn't be a better host. You know, he'd be back there behind the bar, pulling pints, cracking jokes. He was a very fun, renegade, sort of seemed very youthful, middle-aged rocker, you know. And yes, his story is fantastic. You know, he started out with a band called The Creation, who are probably some of the progenitors of garage rock from the British invasion time.
Right.
And he went on to be in the British version of The Birds,
right,
spelled B-I-R-D-S,
yes,
with Ron Wood. But as a member of both of those bands, I mean, he really cut a path for everybody. It was a style of music that wasn't dependent on the adults producing them and making them manicured. They were very raw and real, and their music stands up so well as a result of that.
Right, right. Well, yeah, no, obviously I wasn't as familiar with Kim as I am with Eva, actually. Yeah. But, you know, it sounds like he's got a pretty impressive story. Now, tell me, how does Valentino work into here? Something about they lived at the villa, which was a Valentino estate or something. I wasn't quite tracking.
Yes. So soon after meeting him at the pub, I learned that he also was one of the renters in this apartment unit, this apartment building, I should say, called Villa Valentino, up on Highland Boulevard, a couple blocks from the Hollywood Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And among other luminaries who lived there was my old friend who I'd gone to junior high and high school with whom I was in one of my earliest successful signed bands, Katie Sagal.
Katie's married with children, Katie Sagal.
Yes, and about 6 other incredibly successful franchise series,
yes,
that she's
on.
Yes,
I loved that show. Amazing.
Yeah. Lovely, lovely woman. I hear that she mentioned me on a recent podcast interview with Mark Maron. So.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, back to that. Katie Sagal was living at Villa Valentino. right sort of next to where Paula and Kim Gardner were living before Eva was even born. And so it was a real family scenario. And there was like Melrose Place of musicians and artists and writers. And I would imagine that that Villa Valentino has served as a home for artists and such ever since it was built. It was initially built by Rudolph Valentino, hence the name Villa Valentino.
Right.
As I think guest homes for some of his quote unquote friends. Most of them female.
We'll leave that to your imagination. Is this like a Playboy Mansion sort of a complex?
Yes. Picture Playboy Mansion with everyone having their own apartment rather than one big mansion. Yeah. It's a lovely, lovely place. Anyway, they all lived there and it became quite a family. A lot of sharing of music and ideas and passing joints and just having a great time together. Lovely, lovely time.
Very cool. So Kim being the party animal, it sounds like he may have been.
He may have been.
So rightfully so, Eva talks a lot about how her dad was not supportive of her going into the music industry. And with his background, I can kind of see why. He had three girls. Eva, this is cutting room floor material, but Eva has two sisters that I believe were twins. And Eva says that she is the one of the three of them that really wanted to kind of follow in his footsteps a little bit, loved music, loved guitar. And he was not having it, that Andy Johns taught her to play. And he didn't want any part of it. I mean, he finally ends up coming around. But knowing, I guess, Kim, how you did, and do you have any take on maybe why he didn't want Eva to be in the music industry? And then second part to that question would be, how would you advise young kids today? You know, if they have a really big passion for music. I mean, you've been through the industry. What would you say to people?
Well, I'll take both parts of that. I'll take the second part of that first, because that's the most recent thing you've asked me. yeah, I guess for kids, you know, for me and for Eva, it really comes down to desire.
Right.
Like, I didn't have a choice.
Right.
I was just feeling it. It was down in my bones. It was rushing through my blood. The very first time I heard rock and roll, as I've said before, as a result of having this amazing musical half-sister, Jean, who is 15 years my elder.
Right.
Anyway, in her case, she's raised around it with her dad being a rock star or, you know, the storied career of a man who had been a rock star. By this time, he was more of a pub owner by the time she was born. In any case, I think that if a young kid shows desire and determination and that sort of that X factor of I have to do it, it's just in me and I've got to do it, that hunger, that desire, then all bets are off. I think it's a great path. And you know what? Music could use more hungry, desirous young blood coming in, and especially rock and roll that is so vital and it was so important to so many people. And it's a little bit of a dying language like Latin is, you know?
Right.
It's a little bit like jazz. In other words, there are other kinds of music that have taken over, other styles of music that have taken over. But back to the first part of your question. When I think about Eva's story with her dad, Kim, I mean, I got the feeling from her, and maybe I'm mistaken, that it hurt her feelings that her dad wasn't more supportive.
Right. I got that feeling as well.
And I think I remember saying in the moment, well, it sounds to me like he was just being protective of you because you're his little Eva. Well, and then you sort of extrapolate, go forward from that, and you just think, well, what was Kim like as a young kid? And he can only project onto her, what would it be like for her to be anywhere close to what he was like? And it would be a disaster for a parent to think, oh, she's out there going to the pubs, acting like a clown, you know, and being a bit irresponsible and all of the stuff that comes along with that.
Right.
Of course, 1964, 65 was a very different time.
Right, of course.
So I would just think that more than anything, if I were Eva, I would look at it again and go, that was my dad protecting me. That was my dad wanting a better future for me than he had himself.
Right. Know? Well, she's managed to create quite an amazing future for herself in rock and roll. I mean, playing with Cher and Gwen Stefani and Moby and now Pink for over a decade.
Yeah,
I mean,
right?
It's a pretty impressive resume that she's created for herself. So it's very interesting. And one thing I also think it maybe goes a little bit to what we just talked about, but kids leaving school to go be in bands. That happened all the time when you were growing up. I mean, you left school. Almost every person that we've talked to in season one has gotten opportunities and left school or just knew that that's what they wanted to do. Even if they didn't have the big opportunity yet, that's the path that they were going to take. And they did not continue pursuing school beyond high school. Some of them left in the middle of high school. Eva, however, got opportunities while in high school from the Wallflowers, which is a huge band.
Right, Jacob Dylan's band.
Exactly. Yeah. And she said no. She went on to even go to ethnomusicology class. I think it was LA County Music School. So she, you know, not only said no to that, but then she went on to further her education.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, I guess just trusting that the opportunities would be there. I don't know. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not sure I would have made that same decision. I took multiple leaves of absence from school to do various jobs and ended up finally finishing. But and clearly we know you didn't continue on with school. You left to go be the musical director for Etta James. But what would you advise kids now? I mean, we're talking about how we need another generation of rockers, right? You know, I mean, we need to keep that rock and roll going. But when you have that opportunity, do you stay or do you go?
Ooh, hey, that sounds like a song title.
Totally original.
Oh my God, you're blushing right now. Everyone out there, I just want you to know, this is what Mandy looks like when she's blushing.
Because I had no clue I was going to say that. It was totally spontaneous.
Well, it's a really good question. And I think that it's a really good question. And I think that, again, it goes back to desire, because you've got to want it so badly and show a real acumen for it and talent for it, you know, just in you to make up for maybe the lack of knowledge. Now, I would also say that the kind of music that I wanted to make isn't as popular now as it was then.
Right, right. Yeah,
where this was band-oriented, artist-oriented, songwriter-oriented. Now it's more producer-oriented. And those producers, they don't need many musicians. They do it all on a computer.
Oh, yeah. Pop music. Digital's taken over, yeah.
You know, pop music, hip-hop, if that's even still a word.
Yeah.
If hip-hop
is I don't know, is it? Let us know out there if you're listening.
Yeah, really. Do those kids still call it hip-hop? Anyway, so, I mean, I can only guess with Eva. I kind of think that she did a calculation in her mind that she might be running at a slight disadvantage, as she may have seen it, being a woman trying to break into a young woman breaking into a successful career. And wouldn't she need just a few more arrows in the quiver rather than just plain old good desire and a rock and roll spirit? She had that in spades, but she probably said, I think I could be more of a hot property if I knew a bunch too.
Well, and that goes into reading music. I mean, she went to college and she did, or went on to ethnomusicology school. And I just like saying that word now because I figured out how to say it. So I may say
ethnomusicology.
I may get it in here a few more
times. It's
a
very musical phrase. Ethnomusicology.
So you have to listen to the episode to hear exactly what that is. Because I'm gonna mess that up. But she got a no from that school the first time she auditioned. And it was interesting because she couldn't read music. Mm. And most big musicians these days, a lot of them, you, Paul McCartney, you know, to name a couple, don't read music.
Right.
How is that so important now? I mean, obviously you even talk about how Paul McCartney composes. How do you compose and not read music? I mean, how does it work?
Well, in the case of Paul, my experience of him in the studio is that he hears ideas. He hears them in his very melodic, very musical very producer-oriented, arranger-oriented imagination. He right. hears them. He just goes out and does it yeah. on whatever instrument. He right. plays all the instruments. And in my case, I still want to write the music that moved me as a teenager. That's right. what I'm into. I'm right. into garage rock, early rock and roll, rock and soul, and soul music. That's what I'm into. It's what moves me, and I don't really miss any other elements. Now, these days, I think that kids... it doesn't hurt to have an education as well. And in Eva's choice, I think she made a really smart calculation to go and do that, because look at her. Look at who she's played with. Now, I don't know how many times she's needed her reading chops to do that, but it couldn't hurt.
So when you create an original song, then you do basically the same thing that you just talked about with Paul, the same process that you just talked about. You don't ever actually need sheet music for that.
No.
Song. So no need to have to, you know, delineate it in that way you. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
Yeah, I understand how that's hard for people to understand. So it's a great question, because I think a lot of people just wonder how is music made? Like, right. what the heck happens in there?
And so if you are on stage with Paul or whomever, and someone says, we need more of a B flat or a middle C. I mean, did you guys know what those notes are?
Oh, of course,
like,
yes.
to hear them, but you just, okay.
You know where they are on your guitar or your piano, yes.
Got it.
But so I did read music. As a kid, I did recitals on piano. And so to do that, you have to learn to read music. You're playing sheet music in front of people with a little suit on a stage.
You with a suit on.
Yeah, yeah. Don't laugh. I clean up pretty good. You know? Anyway, you know, but what I wanted to do on piano was learn to play boogie woogie. I wanted to be Jerry Lee Lewis.
Right, right.
And they wanted me to be like, you know, whatever, you know. You know, Brahms or something else. I wasn't very interested in that.
So we're going to take a little bit of a turn right now and talk about being able to compartmentalize on stage. You and Eva had a really, really touching moment in this interview where I don't even know if you guys both realized that you shared such common ground on a very, very sad topic, and that is that both of your fathers died while you were on tour.
Yeah.
And, you know, and her, it turned out that it was her first tour. So, I mean, that's the first, I mean, all these new experiences for her when she's first going out, and her father, you know, is finally on board with her dream to be a musician, and then he's dying as she's leaving, and he ultimately dies. She had to go on that tour, continue playing, of course, yeah. you know, and away from home. Her family's not there to support her. You had to do very similar, that you had a show that night when you found out that your father died, and that night you were playing a show with Johnny Holiday.
Yeah.
How do you do that? I mean, you've got to imagine that musicians are not machines, right? I mean, things happen. You have a bad phone call before you go on stage. I mean, you find out, you know, something like a death, and you've got to go play. How do you do that? How do you actually compartmentalize that?
You know, it's a good question. I, in the case of my father's passing, it was the summer of 1999. And I think I was expecting that he would pass while I was on tour. And when I said goodbye to go on tour, and he and I were very close by this time, mm-hmm. we had really patched things up and then some. And I'm very, very grateful for that. That's a story for another time. But I was nonetheless gutted, because you never expect that call. And yes, I did have a show. We were in Monaco. And we were playing the Sporting Club, which is like Richie Rich of the richest.
Oh, man.
And the ceiling retracts, and you're under the stars, and the stage comes out as the ceiling retracts. It's like black tie.
Any other night, that would be very cool.
Any other night, that would be very cool. We were playing a week-long stand there, I believe. And it wasn't our first night playing. So there was a comfort level, and we'd already set up, we'd already done it once. So it wasn't like I have to go to a big long sound check and then the gig. So now it's comfortable. There is no sound check plan. I had learned about 3 hours before the actual downbeat of the show that my father had passed, and the band leaves the hotel on a bus together. Johnny Hallyday is coming from a separate place, separately, and I chose to only tell a few people because I just didn't really think it was fair to other people to lay it on them right before we're supposed to go and rock out.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
It's just a tough thing. But I made a call, and that call was, I'll tell Abe Jr., mm-hmm. the fabulous, amazing Gabe Jr.
Who you're still quite good friends with, obviously.
Yes. So I elected to tell Abe. We busted out a couple of Cuban cigars, mm-hmm. smoked them on the edge of the marina there in Monte Carlo, as you do. And then we went in like 20 minutes before the show. Everyone was very nervous because we were much later than the band bus because we went to smoke a cigar and talk. And Abe couldn't have been a more lovely friend and ally, just great listener, just so sweet. And we got through that really well. And I, again, elected not to tell Johnny, not to tell the promoter, the producer of the show, any of the other musicians, just Abe and I knew. And I decided that I would use this as fuel to go play from my heart and soul in a way that maybe you don't when you're in the routine of a tour.
Right.
I was calling upon something else. I went out and turned in a stormer, as they would say in the biz, meaning that you played a great show. And the next night when Johnny Hallyday did find out the news that my father had passed and that I had played a show right after learning that, he was very, very sweet. And he says, oh, you played a great show last night. You know, and he was just so kind. And then, as I've said before, he gave me this amazing ring and we went out to dinner together. And, you know, he really made something of that for me. And it continues to be a memory of when I look down at this very ring every time I look down. That reminds me of another thing. Etta James, when I was a little kid, I remember asking her, how do you go on stage? Same question you asked me. How do you go on stage, Etta, after, you know, getting that brutal phone call I heard you on where someone's just giving it all and you're just mad and you're yelling and you have a cold and then you go out and you are funny and fun and available and you sing your ass off. How in the hell do you do that? She goes, Brian, you know, you got to call on the warriors within you.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I just thought that was such a cool thing. And I kind of carry that with me. It's like, you don't just come with your knowledge or your schooling, your education on music. You come with that, whatever that was that drove you to do something as crazy as pursue a life in music.
Well, I guess that's kind of a good life lesson as well for anybody, because everyone's got, you know, had a really horrible day and has a huge meeting. You know, you see, right. You know, the NFL players who have the best game of their life right after someone, you know, close to them passed. I mean, in every walk of life, this is relevant, but just good advice from Dear Etta.
Yeah, from Dear Etta. That's right.
And while we're on Etta James, another shocking part about this interview was that Etta babysat Eva.
Right.
I mean, how does that happen? So Etta was friends with her parents, apparently.
And that whole crew at that aforementioned apartment building that still stands up on Highland Boulevard near the Hollywood Bowl, Villa Valentino. Well, Etta didn't have a place there, but she knew half of the tenants from this or that, you know, and she knew Kim's wife, Eva's mom, of course, Paula. And they were very, very good friends. And then as a result, she also met Katie Sagal, mm-hmm. my old buddy.
Right.
And at that time, that's right. Katie Sagal's husband of that time, who I had introduced her to, is named Freddie Beckmeyer. And they were married, living next door to Paula and Kim. And Freddie Beckmeyer, I asked to come and play with Etta James. And this is like 1976.
Oh, wow.
And he was from Philly. And so that's part of it. I mean, Etta was, of course, close with the people that she had in her band. And soon Katie Sagal sang with Etta James.
Oh my gosh.
Another 3 years later, Katie was in the band too.
Okay, it's genuinely all in the family. And now you mentioned, I think last week after show, that you are a godfather to one of her children.
I am. I'm the godfather.
Yeah. Which son of hers?
Etta had two sons, the first named Donto and the second named Sameto. Donto was about 4 years old when I joined her band. And years after that, Meto was born, as we call him, Meto. And gosh, we have great memories of him as just a newborn, just a toddler, swimming in the pools together. And I used to call him my little water bug. And I still do. We still talk.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And he'll sign off with "your little water bug."
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
So that's super cute.
I'm a godfather. And yeah, he's a lovely, lovely dude.
Well, I can't believe that we are this far into this interview and I've really not even talked about the ridiculously amazing badass women that Eva has shared the stage with.
Right.
I mean, Gwen Stefani, Pink, Cher. One thing that I really love is that all of these women are welcoming of other women on stage, because that seems to be a problem in the industry where there's that competition, you know, women not wanting that competition on stage. Eva talks about it quite a bit. I've heard that story often, sadly, but these women brought it, you know, they welcome it. They want to see other women shine. Do you see that happen in the industry? Is that just a shitty girl thing, or does that happen in guy bands too? Or like, where are we at on that?
Yeah. Well, I don't think I've really seen it, but then I don't look through the same eyes as a woman would. And
Right. Maybe
that goes back to just me supposition that maybe Eva was desirous of an education in music as one more arrow in her quiver. Maybe she sensed that she could have trouble with some female band leaders and other musicians in a band being a female as the new girl in the band, like the new kid in school, because she's pretty looking and very talented and very shiny and very positive.
Totally.
So she kind of probably felt like she needed some more warriors within her to call on, and she decided education. So I haven't really seen that myself because I'm looking through different eyes as a man, but I'll tell you that for sure, Pink, Gwen Stefani, and Cher are three very confident women.
Oh, completely.
And
yeah,
they are the opposite of insecure. And yes, they would probably see Eva or any talented woman as a value add, not as a distraction.
Right.
You know?
And that just doesn't happen with guys, though, it sounds like. I mean, guys are just cool with other guys like being on stage.
Yeah, you just don't want anyone that looks hotter than you. You just got to keep it real. No, I'm kidding. So yeah, guys are a little different in that way. You know, we have each other's backs for the most part, you know?
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
Girls should take a lesson.
Yeah, girls.
Come on, girls.
Check it out.
No, so also the really cool thing about Pink, which I was a little bit taken aback by. I mean, I don't know Pink at all, but I thought this was really cool. I didn't see this coming, that she is like a very bonding leader of the band and plans barbecues and plans birthdays and really wants the band to be getting together and be friends. And Eva says that they genuinely are like a family off stage and outside of tours. And Steve Lukather talks about this as well, is that you have to be able to hang with the band, but we didn't really get into you with Paul and your other bands. Has that been a thing with you? Do you guys get together quite a bit outside of the shows?
It's been the case in most of the bands I've been with.
Okay.
And I think back to many of them, from Etta James, and we were talking last time we met about the casual barbecues out by her place on Athens Boulevard. And many of the other bands I've been with, Laura Branigan's band, while on tour, we had a softball team.
Oh, you know? Did? Oh, that's
yeah,
cute.
Yeah, and we ruled because we had a couple of ringers in the band. Trust me, it wasn't me. But I held my own, but I wasn't what you would call a ringer.
At least I didn't have to say it.
I wasn't a liability, but I was not a ringer. Anyway, super fun. And I think that, you know, touring, you better be able to hang, or it's brutal.
Right.
You know, because, you know, cliques will form. In the case of Pink, and we only really spoke about that one in her career, because it's her current family. It's current tour family.
Right.
I would imagine that Cher and Gwen Stefani had raging, wonderful dinner parties and hangs as well.
Oh, I'm positive, yeah.
But Pink is, you know, she's like, apparently, just a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds that way. Okay, so we speaking of fun, we've got to get to Eva's most embarrassing moment because I was crying. I'm not sure if you could actually hear me on the interview, but I was dying laughing when she was telling this story. I had to walk into another room. But tell me, how does one put their head in a bass drum? For those of us, we know that there's that Mylar thing, you know, on the front that has a logo, but where does one's head go if you want to stick your head in the bass drum?
Right. So for people who don't know out there, the bass drum in a drum set is the great big one that you're looking straight at, you know, that you see the drum head or skin facing, and it often has the band's logo on it. Well, what you might not know is they cut a head-sized hole in in the bass drum, perfectly round, not shaped like a head, and sometimes not quite as big as a head, through which to place the cable that goes to the microphone that gives the sound to the sound man from the kick drum, the kick drum microphone. So inside that kick drum will also be maybe a sandbag or a pillow, or, you know.
Maybe that's what she was going for, the pillow.
She wanted a nap. There was just a nice feathery pillow. So anyway, she in, you know, what could be a cutting room floor scene cut from Spinal Tap, decided the thing to do was, I can't get enough kick drum. I will prove that. And the drums are often up on a riser. So it's not like you have to be on your hands and knees to do this.
Right, right.
It's not quite... I'm going to get you going again.
God.
It was not quite as awkward as you might think. It's not like her tuchus is up in the air and her head's down on the ground.
Well, if you check out our social media, one of the pictures we put up is her right by the bass drum, right by the drum kit. So you can see how they elevate it, and you can see where her head may find her way in, but it's very awkward.
Ladies and gentlemen, go look at our social medias right now, all of them. You will see her not with her head in the bass drum, but standing right behind it, right beside it. So you can see how this might happen. Well, she stuck her head in that hole just to see if she could get even more kick drum, because that's what, as a bass player, you're married to. You're married to the drums, and specifically
to the beat.
The kick drum.
And then she gets stuck, but she somehow keeps playing.
Yeah.
What, like, would you think you could do that?
I wouldn't do that. But,
You wouldn't put your head in the bass drum, or you wouldn't keep playing once you put your head in the bass drum?
My head's too big. No, I do have a fairly big head. No jokes. No.
I'm holding my tongue.
Okay. So, well, she decided that was the thing to do. In doing so, she couldn't extricate herself from the bass drum. She was just left with her head in there. It would come out like a dog in a fence. It's so cute.
I did not envy you during that interview because, like I said, I had to run out of the room and you spit out your water. It was like we were all a hot mess during that story.
I did hear some wheezing like from you from the other room. It was like...
Oh, I did not have it together. So, so funny. Okay, so we are going to wrap it up now with the audience questions and then our lightning round.
Okay.
All right, so a couple audience questions for you. Before tours, do you always have rehearsals the week before you go out, or are you guys rehearsing together, rehearsing separately? Kind of how does that work before big tours?
Well, it's different for every band. In the case of Paul's band, what used to happen is the band would get together for 5 or 6 days and run through the songs that Paul has named, the newer songs that he wants to run through, new and old, and from his giant career, you know, whether it's solo or Wings or his former band.
Right.
His other former band. You know, and then the band would get comfortable with that stuff because there's a lot to learn. There's vocals to learn, you know, who plays what. And a little bit of that is sausage making. So We kind of figured that we would like to get enough of that done so Paul doesn't, you know, like to keep things moving.
Right.
So we don't get bogged down figuring little stuff out. But in the case of our more recent tours for the last, say, 8-10 years, we just get together and bang them out from note one, a new song from 1967 or 1978, you know, whatever.
So the rehearsals at this point are not overly grueling, it doesn't sound like, because you guys have pretty much played everything at least at some point.
Right. You know, it's work. Our rehearsals are real work. We work for a good 6-7 hours every time we get together.
Wow.
We take a little lunch break. But, you know, it's not just all rainbows and toadstools. It's serious work, and you're standing up for all that time, and you're wearing a, you know, 8-to-12-pound instrument over your shoulder.
Right, of course.
And singing and, you know, staying on it. And
well, and you kind of got to be in shape too.
That too. Yeah.
I mean, you need to like make sure that you're like in shape enough to play a 3-hour show ultimately. And, you know, that it's just, it's a lot. All right. So lightning round. We have talked a lot about some very serious badass women in this episode. In your opinion, dead or alive, most impressive female artist?
Well, I'm going to have to say Etta James. I mean, I'm sorry.
I thought so.
I'm so biased, but, you know, she was just a wonder to me.
Yeah.
Remarkable. And so much of it was also knowing her story and the struggles from which she arose.
Right.
Yeah. So right. I would say Etta James.
All right. Bigger obsession, shoes or sunglasses?
Oh, sunglasses.
Do we know how many pairs of sunglasses you have?
No.
Do you care to take a guess on this episode?
No.
The funniest thing, though, Brian comes in and he says, oh, man, I've lost my favorite pair of sunglasses. And my response was, what? Good thing you have 500 other pairs of sunglasses.
Yeah, good point. I forgot.
All right. Well, Eva Gardner, thank you so much. Awesome, awesome interview. If you haven't listened to that, please go back and do so. If for nothing else, her hysterical head in the drum story.
I mean, it's one of a kind. You've got to hear it.
All right. Thank you so much, Brian. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. On Tour and The After Show are productions of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by me, Mandy Wimmer, with executive producer Noel Brown. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews or to submit questions for The After Show, visit our social media at On Tour Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.